Okay, so we're going to talk about the radio observations of GW-1708-17, and I'm here on behalf of a large group doing observations across many telescopes. First, some intro on what radio mission we can expect. Of course, we expect radio mission with the... This isn't working, is it? Okay. You can expect radio mission associated with the dynamical ejecta on timescales of months to years, for example, the Karen Perrin 2011, Olkazak and Perrin 2015. Oh, thank you. It traces the ISN surrounding circummerger density and the energy in the ejecta, and that's on longer timescales. As has been discussed, the presence of relativistic jet will also give you a component of radio emission, possibly, depending on your orientation. We have constraints, of course, from H-naught. So what you see in that case is a much more rapidly rising afterglow, potentially, and you see a peak luminosity at one over angle between your observer and the edge of your jet. And then the third possibility here, and by the way, I'm taking images from the NASA movie and completely co-opting them. Maybe not as they're originally intended, but for now, it'll have to do. Here I'm showing this as a cocoon. Everyone else probably calls this a jet. And in that case, we're talking about the interaction of the jet with dynamical ejecta. Okay, that's what I've taken to be the definition of the cocoon. And two possibilities. One, that there is all the energy of the jet is dumped into the dynamical ejecta. That is a strong cocoon. There will not be a GRBC somewhere in the universe. The other being that the jet dumps some of its energy into the ejecta. You still have jet breakout, and somewhere in the universe, someone sees a GRB. That's what I understood the definition to be for these events. But there's, yeah, I'm sure. Well, this is something. Yeah, we will talk about the possibility of the high velocity tail of the dynamical ejecta also. Okay, Well, of course, you've got timescales from months to years, days to weeks, weeks to months. We can't ask the VLA to give us years worth of time to observe every day. And the first few days, of course, everyone was observing very intensively, and there were some very strong limits on an on-axis jet that was discussed, and I'll discuss more later on. But what definitely for me, of course, we're in the MMA era now, we can kind of draw on information across the wave bands to decide when to observe. For me, what was very important, we saw gamma rays, a weak gamma ray burst, but no bright afterglow on Swift or in Chandra or a new star. We saw, of course, optical and IR and ultraviolet. And then in 9 days, we saw the X-ray afterglow. And then a bit later on, we saw the mid-infrared that Monty discussed. When this X-ray showed up, that got us all very excited in the radio world, because with X-ray should appear radio, assuming a single component. So we began very intensively in our team, focusing on observing with the VLA, still the biggest and most sensitive interferometer on the planet, the GMRT in India, and the compact array in Australia. About a week after the very first detection in X-rays, there was a detection in radio. This is an observation at 3 gigahertz, 16 days post-merger. I was working with Kanan Mooli, and we found the source separately. Alessandro Corsi observed immediately after and independently at a different frequency, found it, which is really a good confirmation for us. It was observed a few days later by the compact array in Australia. Separately, another team led by Kay Alexander observed it again about 10 days later. So we were pretty confident that we were seeing the afterglow. Our strongest confirmation was, though, that it was rising over the following 2 weeks. And that was really our indicator we'd found the right source. So here's the light curve we had from 16 days post-merger to day 31, which is the cutoff we had for getting something into press in time for October 16. Giving you about 2 weeks worth of data. Everyone else was kind of writing their papers around about here. We were frantically writing around about here. So what can we constrain? Let's talk first about the how the modeling is done. And of course, the modeling team is led by Udi, with Kenta's here also. Svi and Aura is here, I think, at the audience as well, too. Doing great time to do a thesis, actually. So the models are based on work that's been previously published by Soderberg et al. 2006. And Holgazak and Perrin 2013, I think is the year. The results are consistent with boxfish based on comparison, and in all cases, the models we show here would be assuming epsilon E of 0.1 and epsilon B of 0.01. And based on consistency with the X-ray data, we assume P equals 2.2. Okay? So, what do we constrain? I think no one's going to debate this one, thankfully. The models, we have a very weak detection of gamma rays very early on, and one argument you could say is, well, we're seeing a weak on-axis jet of very low luminosity. Well, there's many reasons to argue against that. Kaiser-Wallin et al. Demonstrate that it wouldn't be able to break through. But there's also direct evidence from X-ray and radio in that there's no early fading after the low. And for example, Alexander et al., as was shown by Raphael, like with early observations with Alma and VLA, showed that there was no bright early afterglow. And more, I think as well, very strongly, the fact that you see a rising radiant X-ray light curve week to 2 weeks after the event is more consistent with something that's off-axis. So the next question, is it slightly off-axis or widely off-axis? And here the radio, I think, has a very strong point to make in that you can look at the, if you take a slightly off-axis view and say you're just seeing a normal classical GRB and just catching the edge of the jet, so you know a few degrees off axis, what you know is that consistent with what we're seeing? And then the radio really does, I think, provide some constraints there, because what you should see, depending on your ISM density, is a bright early time afterglow for slightly off axis. And you have to go down to extremely low on physical actually densities in order to fit the data, and that really rules out this idea of slightly off axis. Then you get to the case that, well, that must mean that you're widely off axis, and that's where the debates have been all day long, of course. I have some of the references in question here relating to the Cocoon model, as well as off axis jet. Many more, I didn't read all 100 of them, but of course we'll discuss them more this week. All right, what models are consistent? Well, with only a few data points in a very compressed time frame, it turns out most models are consistent with the early time light curve. Here's what we actually took as our initial model. We tried to model a strong cocoon. And in this case, we modeled a strong cocoon. We modeled a weak cocoon, which is the black light curve. We modeled the tail of the Kilanova eject, the dynamical eject, the velocity tail, and then also a jet. Now, for this particular, these three models, which are basically just the Kilanova tail and the cocoon, we just assumed a very simple model, a shell of single velocity material expanding outwards, which, like Raffaella pointed out, would rise as t cubed. In the case of a top hat of axis jet, it will rise faster, it will have a flat top, and will fade as a power law. All these models were still consistent, and they all kind of suggested a low-density environment. There are many other papers that are also fitting for the off-axis jet, for example, Raffaella and Kayla Alexander's papers, and then there's, of course, Nora's results she showed later on, both for a normal top hat of axis jet and a structured jet. So, what I also thought was very interesting, though, was that based on this work that was done from Monty's paper, Orr and others did some simulations, 2D simulations, to try and explain the gamma rays. And based on the resulting velocity profile, they fit that to the radio data also. And because it wasn't a single component velocity ejecta, it wasn't rising as t cubed, it rises much more slowly. I'll get back to that. Okay, so what have we ruled out? Nothing at that stage. Right, it was a lot of fun. We discovered the source, but what have we ruled out? Not much so far. However, what we did perceive was that the light curve at day 100 really should distinguish between the ejected morphologies in question. And the two morphologies I'm thinking about here are a collimated off-axis jet, which, like we already described, will have a rapid rise, will peak at approximately 1 over gamma, where gamma is equal to the angle between your observer and the edge of the jet, and a quasi-spherical component. So this would be quasi-spherical, this would be quasi-spherical. So that will give you that, that will distinguish between these two models and this model. Separately, your size gives you another orthogonal way to approach the problem. Size will distinguish between your dynamical ejecta and those that are expanding at a higher velocity. Okay? Combined, you can break all degeneracies, we hope. Okay, and I'm going to talk about the latest paper we had last week, which is actually extending the light curve on to almost 100 days, and I'll talk about future plans for VLBI. Okay, so that was light curve at day 16 to day 31. What happened in the following 2 months? Well, it kept on rising. This is a paper that appeared last week on Archive and has been provisionally accepted to Nature. And we see that there's essentially a smooth rise, almost monotonic. And that allowed us to do very, very easily then to try and get a good fit on the spectral index and the temperate index for this afterglow. And our results are, we had alpha equals about 0.61 plus or minus 0.05. And our temperate index about 0.78 plus or minus 0.05. Here on the top is showing all the upper limits. and light curve and detections rather as a function of frequency, and now correcting for spectral index, so they all lie essentially very close to near point. Subtracting off that model, you can see the dispersion around the model. Comparison with X-ray. What was nice now is that we had a radio-only measurement of spectral index of about 0.61, and that's actually very consistent with what was measured for the comparison with the radio and X-ray at about day 15 or so. And here's an example from Raffaella's paper where we can see that, that's actually using 0.6, and it's consistent with the radio-only spectral index, which favors that the radio is indeed the same component which you see in the X-ray. Here on this plot right here, we're showing this is a very busy plot, but the blue points here are the exact same as here, and we can see that at a different epoch, the radio has got brighter, and ergo the X-ray should also get brighter. So I hope you have success in the next few days, unless of course the Coulomb break has dropped a bit below the X-ray, for example. So getting back to how that fits with our previous models, here's what I showed earlier on exactly: the predictions for a simple spherical ejecta, single velocity, and for a jet, and we see that it doesn't fit any of those data. And in fact, we tried for a whole range of jet models, and I'd like to talk to Raffaella about that, because we could find no, it's rising constantly, so we could find no jet parameters that fit these data, simple jet parameters that fit these data. Here, what we found is consistent, and very simply, we're looking at something that's quasi-spherical. It can be modeled with a single one-dimensional velocity profile, E greater than beta gamma, where the exponent is minus 5. Okay, and that's important. There's more energy in the slower-moving ejecta. Okay, and I want to address the question you had, Ido. You said, like, what's the difference between all these models and what's important? This is just isolating now the model from Guthrie et al. That's a prediction. That's not a post facto, here's a fit. That was a prediction made on October 16th that what the radio will do in the event of a cocoon. So where are we on this? What we have ruled out is a classical on-axis jet with a short Jacobian afterglow. What we ruled out is an off-axis jet with, at least we're ruling this out as a source of the radio emission. Let's be very clear here. We're just saying what actually fits the radio emission. We're ruling out a simple off-axis top hat jet as a source of the gamma rays and afterglow. What we're saying is less likely, but still possible, is that there's a successful hidden jet. So we're seeing a cocoon producing, you know, gamma rays and X-rays and radio, and maybe there's a jet still hidden that we haven't seen yet. That's possible. It's a bit contrived because it requires a lot more energy in the cocoon than in the jet. The other possibility is that you actually have the radio emission come from the fast tail of the dynamical ejecta, and in fact, you know, I mentioned Orr's model here. These other two models are fits that were made using this constraint, and there's two different velocity ranges, one for a cocoon, which is the gamma max of 3.5, and one for just the high velocity tail of the ejector, which still fits the data. The only weakness for that particular model is it can't explain the gamma rays because of compactness arguments. What can explain the radio and the X-rays, and can also explain the gamma rays, is this model of a cocoon. How do we kind of really confirm between, for example, the kilonova tail versus the cocoon model? And that's bringing in our other tool that we have in our toolbox, which is basically how the size will distinguish between dynamical ejecta and anything that's mildly relativistic, be it a cocoon or an off-axis jet. Because we have this cool trick in radio astronomy where we can strap together telescopes across the globe to make a mega-telescope. It's called VLBI. Here we're using the very large baseline array, which is 10 dishes across the US. That's not sensitive enough. So we added in the Green Bank dish, which is the largest single steerable dish in the world, and also the very large array. So we have this 38-dish array. It's called the HSA when combined, which means high sensitivity array. It has the sensitivity, and we hope the resolution to maybe resolve the ejecta directly. So we actually presented some arguments in our first paper that were very hand-wavy, where we said, well, this should be smaller than this, right? What we really need is a much more careful modeling of what we expect to see in VLBI, such that we are once again making predictions, not fitting data post facto. So right now, Orr and others are working on producing predictions of what we expect to see for both the cocoon, which is shown here, and also the dynamical ejecta. What I'm showing you here is the scale of the problem. This is our beam for the VLBA, the array I showed you, the HSA, at 6 gigahertz, where we're observing. And you can see that the full of half max is about 1.4 milliarcseconds. And that might seem like that's impossible, but actually, if we get enough signal to noise, we can fit that Gaussian and actually get a good measure of what the size of the ejector will be. So that's what we're really focusing on trying to do now, is to try to get a measure of the front velocity of the ejector. And hope will be that we get a nice photograph or a snapshot of a neutron star merger. Of course, it'll look more like this. A horrible Gaussian that we'll try to fit and worry about all the noise. But it should, I think, be a powerful alternate means to measure. Summary, radio observations are ongoing and will be ongoing for a long time. The radio-only spectrum is consistent with common origin for radio and X-ray. Like curve to date, favors a quasi-spherical outflow. You can call it whatever you want to. I don't care. It's a quasi-spherical outflow. There's more energy in the slower-moving ejecta. VLBI will possibly distinguish between a cocoon and dynamic ejecta. I say possibly because it's a very difficult observation. And of course, we will see the kilonova tail or kilonova itself at slower velocities rising on timescales of years, potentially. And today for me has been very exciting, also very confusing, as I try to understand what's a cocoon and what's a structured jet. I think it is a good idea to investigate all models. I just hope we're not doing something like this where we're kind of rebranding things. That's what I hope we don't see. But other than that, I think it's all a good discussion and I hope to learn a lot more. All right, thank you.
Questions for Greg?
So how does the inclination angle affect your VLBI measurements?
How does the VLBI affect our measurement, you're saying? It depends on what the size. I mean, I went all the way to the strap and mistake there, sorry. That model you saw there, I think, was for assumed viewing angle of about 26 degrees. That's about 26 degrees. So you can see that it's quasi-spherical. So if it's a cocoon, shouldn't affect it too much.
But if it's extreme, degeneracy.
If it's extreme, it'll be an off-axis jet, I guess, right? Because in this case, you're looking for something that's quasi-spherical. It'll have some structure to it and some shape to it, but it won't be like I don't think you're impacted too much by inclination. But that's something that we'll be able to establish from these models. When ORS paper comes out, we'll have a range of inclinations and a range of different sizes.
Yes, Greg, since the source is still rising in flux and expanding in size, everything points to weighting, but obviously you don't want to get confused by the interaction with the ISM. Do you have a sense of when the optimal time would be or what constraints could be in good place?
Once you start resolving the source significantly, then you don't win anymore, right? Because you're dividing your brightness. But for now, there's plenty of time for it to expand and still win, for sure, I agree. I think our policy is use up all the time we have and then go back begging for more. and say it's so important, it's one event. I think the best time to do it would be somewhere near the peak. So keeping one policy might be just keep observing the light curve with the VLA, look for the turnover and try and observe then. If you had a limited amount of HSA time.
Just for calibration, what's the light crossing distance on that image?
This one here?
Yeah.
Well, it's been traveling at, it's basically gamma of 2.5 for 3 months, so.
About 5 times 10 to 17.
Yeah. Okay.
More questions for Greg.
So I get a sense of the scale of what you're trying to measure. So you're measuring something that's moving at sea for the cocoon, whereas the tail of the ejecta is moving, what, 0.5?
So right now, 0.7 or so, I guess.
So you're trying to, the distinction you have to make is between 0.7 and 1 C.
Factoring in gamma as well. You got.
You gain because you have superluminal motion.
Right.
Basically, the size is going like gamma.
Times gamma, yeah.
So we have about a factor of 2.
Factor of 2, yes.
This is like the kilonova tail is like point
gamma 1.3. That seems, factor of 2 seems doable with this resolution.
I think if we get a signal to noise of about 20, we should be able to do it pretty cleanly, I hope.
Does this asymmetry is real?
Sorry?
Asymmetry.
Oh, there is asymmetry involved in this, right? Because this is one viewing angle, and the models will have a range of
So this is an observation.
No. Sorry, oh, no. This is a preliminary model for an assumed viewing angle of about 30 degrees, and we're trying to say here's what our resolution element is, and trying to demonstrate how much signal to noise we have to.
So it's hopeless to do this at millimeter or other wavelengths where we have much higher resolution interferometers.
So yeah, you're trading off signal to noise. Signal to noise is almost the same as resolution in this instance. You're fitting a Gaussian, and your actual ability to fit the Gaussian is just this divided by 2 times signal to noise. So when you go down to millimeter, you will have maybe 10 times more spatial resolution, but you will have less sensitivity, and I think you end up losing always. I think the where it works out being about best is 6 gigahertz. Alma can't even detect this source.
One part of the spectrum where there are no detections.
Yeah.
No, not. I mean, all the Alma observations were before. In the first month or so.
Right.
It's rising.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, we know what the spectrum is, so.
Right. You can do a calculation
of. It's going to be tough for Alma.
It's basically a trade-off of your signal to noise versus your gain in resolution. I think you always win between 6 and 8 or so.
More questions for Greg.
It's also much easier at these frequencies, much easier.
Well, if not, let's thank Greg and all of the speakers.